Okay, it's a pleasure to have an opportunity to talk here to both the condensed matter and the string theory audiences. So this is the work which I did with my colleague John McGreevy and also two students, David Wei and Tom Faulkner. So one paper appeared in March, and another should appear either later this week or early next week. And there are also two very relevant papers. One is by Sang-Sik Lee, whose paper actually initiated this program we are pursuing here. And also there's a very closely related paper to our earlier paper, which by these authors. So Joe and Shankar told us the proper way to think about the Landau Fermi liquid is to think of it as a fixed point of low energy effective field theory around the Fermi surface. And this fixed point is stable, modular BCS type of instabilities, and it can be also considered as essentially to have a 1+1 dimensional free fermion CFT sitting at each point of the Fermi surface. And when you are slightly away from the Fermi surface, then you're just patching all these different CFT together using the forward scattering. So this RG point view makes it inevitable that non-Fermi liquid should exist, because there's no reason why the fixed point should be described by free fermions. And there should be other non-trivial fixed points. And indeed, they are both theoretical and experimental. Of course, this is hindsight. and then so from theory point of view, of course, in 1+1 dimension, and even the most conventional fixed point is not the Fermi liquid; it's the so-called Nottinger liquid, which have very different properties, and then if also in higher dimensions, if you couple, free fermions to gauge fields, then you can get the non-Fermi liquid. Yeah, 1+1. That's right. And experimental level, of course, the people the normal state of high TC cooperates near the optimally doped region. And also the heavy fermion near the quantum critical points, and are examples of such. So the key concept in the Landau theory, in the Landau Fermi liquid theory, is a quasi particle, is that the non-energy excitations around the Fermi surface are described by weakly interacting quasi particles. Just starting from here, you can build the whole phenomenological theory about it. In principle, calculating anything you want. Say thermodynamics, transport, etc. And the quasi particle can be formulated a little bit more formal using the single particle Green function, and say if you define a retarded Green function, say for the electron operator, and then go to the Fourier space, then the quasi particle will appear as a pole. Very close to the real frequency axis, and the imaginary part of the pole, which is proportional to gamma, and is proportional to omega squared. And so when you go to very close to the Fermi surface, so in this talk, I will define K perp is always that the K, the spatial K minus Kf, and omega is always the deviation from the chemical potential. Okay. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. Let me get right on this side. And omega is a deviation from the chemical potential. Right. And so when you scale towards the Fermi surface. And then the width become less important, become less and less important, and essentially get a stable particle with a linear dispersion relation. And this residue z of the quasi particle pole then can be interpreted as some kind of validation factor for the electron wave function. So now let's go to non-Fermi liquids. So we believe that the Schaff Fermi surface should still exist. But in general, quasi particle pictures breaks down. So for example, if we consider the normal state of optically doped cuprates, then from anomalous behavior of the thermodynamic properties and transport properties compared to the standard non-Fermi Fermi liquid, and one concludes that the quasi particle cannot this quasi particle picture cannot yield such a property. And also if one look at the also in the phenomenological say marginal Fermi liquid description of the cuprate in this region, the quasi particle residue vanishes at 1/log omega as you scale towards the Fermi surface. So the residue actually vanishes as you cross goes to the Fermi surface. And another example is that suppose you are sitting at the critical point for a continuous metal and insulator transition. And because this is a continuous transition and the continuous connected to the metal side, so you should have a Fermi surface still at the critical point. But also since you are the continuous connected to the insulator side, and at the Fermi surface, it should not have gapless excitations. And again, from there, you should conclude that the quasi particle residue has to vanish on the Fermi surface, and in principle, there's no quasi particle picture. So suppose that the low energy effective field theory near a Fermi surface is controlled by some kind of long trivial fixed point, say for long Fermi liquid. Then the question is, what do we need to know about the fixed point to really characterize the physical properties of this material? Say the nature of low energy excitation, spectral functions, thermodynamics, transport, etc. And in other words, it's what is the organizing principle for the long Fermi liquid? I believe the answer is still not known. If you think the answer is known, please let me know. Is it known? Then I can stop the talk right now if the answer is known. Okay? So given that the answer is not known, then so can ADS-FT help? Of course, the most basic question is that can we find new examples of long Fermi liquids? They're using gravity. And if yes, can we use ADS-FT by studying those examples to find clues for organizing principle? So I should note that, well, it would be nice to find the gravity description of real life systems. But it might be difficult. Maybe I should not sound so pessimistic before condensed matter audience. But this may not be necessary, because in principle, the ADS-FT can give us an organizing principle or guiding principle to think about the non-Fermi liquids, and then use such kind of dynamical insights, then we should be able to make progress on real systems without a gravity description of the real systems. So now let me review some very basic aspects of ADS-FT just to set up the stage for certain things I need to use today. So first is that the certain d-dimensional conformal field theory is described by string theory in d-1 dimensional anti-de-Sitter space-time. And many examples in different dimensions are now known, including in non-conformal ones. And in such kind of a relation, the conformal symmetries on this side is mapped to the isometries on the anti-de-Sitter side. And the global symmetries in the field theory side typically map to the gauge symmetries in the gravity side. And the large N and strong coupling is a map to the classical gravity. And that's the key point which we are using here, is that the a classical gravity helps you to solve the strong coupling problem. So one of the most important principle in ADS-FT is so-called LRUV connection. So one way to visualize this relation between the bulk and the boundary theory is that let's imagine that the d-dimensional field theory living on this plane. And then the gravity lives in one higher dimension, so you have one more dimension. And then you can imagine this the field theory lives sitting at the boundary of this ADS. So once give you this picture, an immediate question you may ask is that what does this radial direction correspond to from the field theory point of view? And there's a simple heuristic answer to that, is that this direction roughly corresponding to the energy scale in the field theory. For example, the geometry near the boundary, say near the near r equal infinity, typically reflects the UV physics of the boundary field theory, and the geometry deeply in the interior, and typically reflects the IR physics of the boundary field theory. And also, it's very easy to put, the theory at finite density or temperature. So what you do is that you just put a black hole in ADS. And so the difference is that you modify the geometry here a little bit. And also now, the geometry has an even horizon. So now, let me also summarize some very important features of using ADS-FT, say, for many-body physics. So the first is that as all techniques for the many-body physics, it tends to a many-body problem to a single or few-body problem. Say in this case, it's in the black hole geometry. And the second property is actually the most important one, is that often highly quantum mechanical and strong coupling phenomena can be understood from the gravity side just as some kind of simple geometric fact. And there are many such examples known in ADS-FT, for example, confinement, chiral symmetry breaking, etc. They are all very non-trivial on the field theory side, but they can, once recognized properly, they can be understood as simple geometric facts in the gravity side. And also, that thermodynamics and the transport, and the one important aspect is that the gravity can do the thermodynamic and transport without using quasi particles, and they use geometry. And the third aspect is that as I emphasized earlier, the large N strong coupling, the all CFT, they are described by universal factor of the, say, even though each string theory, or even though each CFT is in principle due to a different string theory, and but in the large N strong coupling limit, they all can be described by a universal factor of this string theory. It's Einstein gravity plus matter fields. So that means one can actually learn a universal features of many such kind of field theory just in one shot, just by studying the gravity, the Einstein gravity plus a small number of matter fields. So those aspects will be important in my discussion later. And in particular, you will see. Okay, now let me describe how do we search for non-Fermi liquids from gravity. The idea is very simple. So you take a theory with a gravity dual, and make sure this theory has fermions, and also and let the theory have a U1 global symmetry. And the reason is that we want to put the theory at the finite charge density. And so such a theory at zero temperature is described on the gravity side by extremely charged black hole. So now I will specialize just for definiteness to four dimension to four-dimensional in ADS that corresponding to three space-time direction in the boundary theory. But almost everything I say actually applies to all dimensions. But right now, I will specialize to three-dimensional space-time dimension in the boundary. So at the zero temperature, the gravity side just described by extremely charged black hole, whose matrix can be written like this. And so this warp factor comes from the black hole. If F equal to 1, then you just have a standard ADS. And then you also have a gauge field telling you that the black hole is charged. So mu here is the chemical potential of the boundary theory, of the field theory. And then the horizon is at, I have chosen units so that the horizon is sitting at r equal to 1. And I have also set the radius of ADS to be 1. So immediate question is that if you put the theory at a finite density, which is described by this black hole, the immediate question is, what kind of quantum liquid is that? Does this theory have a Fermi surface? And if yes, is this a Fermi liquid or non-Fermi liquid? So to look for a Fermi surface, we should search for sharp features at finite momentum in fermionic Green functions. As I said earlier, that if you have a Fermi surface, then typically you have the quasi particle type of behavior, quasi particle like behavior around the Fermi surface. So that would be the way to in the Green function. So that would be the way to search it. So even though the idea is it's very simple, I think actually I didn't know anybody have tried it before before Sansik did it last August. So now we just take a fermionic operator in the field theory side, say some spinner, say some spin half operator in the field theory side, and then according to ABS dictionary, that maps to some spinner field, Dirac spinner field in the gravity side. And the dimension of the operator then maps to the mass of these fields. And the charge, so here you have a U1 global symmetry, and then it maps to the U1 gauge symmetry on the gravity side, and then charge just map to each other. And the most important is that the two-point function for O can be found just by solving Dirac equations for this psi. And then extracting the boundary values of the solution. And so I will solely focus on retarded Green function because that's the most convenient one to use. And so here, let me make a comment, is that in order to do a two-point function calculation, on the gravity side, you only need to know the action for this spinner field at the quadratic level. And at the quadratic level, the action is essentially universal. It's just Dirac action coupled to the background geometry. So here, essentially, you have some kind of universality of the two-point function, even at finite density. Is that the answer we are going to compute will not depend on which specific theory and which specific operator we use. And the result will only depend on charge Q and dimension and the dimension delta, as far as and the theory have a gravity dual. So, sorry? Oh, no, it's not for free field theory. You just say, we are interested in the two-point function in the field theory side. And two-point function in the field theory side to do gravity calculation is enough to use the quadratic action. Even though the gravity side have cubic action, etc., but they don't contribute. No, it's not, no. Right, you only need the quadratic gravity action. And the cubic term, they won't contribute, the quadratic term won't contribute. Yeah, to leading order 1 over n. Yeah, to leading order in large n limit, and that's the only thing you need. Yeah, so this is the universality, essentially in the strongly coupled and large n limit.
So
Okay. It actually doesn't matter. On the field theory side, we only treat the gauge invariant quantity. So you only can treat the such Feynmanic excitation which come from the acting gauge invariant operator on the vacuum. So any excitations of the Fermi surface, they have to be gauge invariant. Yeah. The Fermi surface you used to if you use elementary fermions in your Lagrangian to describe a Fermi surface, say at the weak coupling, or that kind of Fermi surface is not gauge invariant. And in order to extract gauge invariant answer, you still have to sandwich such state using the using gauge invariant operator. But you essentially have to do the same thing. Yes? And it's, I think, there's still some level of universality, because in the lowest order, maybe not. I think you can put arbitrary number of derivatives. In principle, not, I think. When the Dirac mass is equal to -3/2? So that's actually a very interesting question. In fact, actually the Dirac mass can only be, when Dirac mass is equal to -3/2, this formula does not apply. And this formula only applies for m equal to positive. And for m equal to negative, when m equal to negative, and then you just put the minus sign here, then you get the same formula. Then there's alternative. So this goes into a technical question. So here we have. Here I said I use standard quantization. For m between 0 and 1/2, then there's a different quantization. And in that quantization, you put a minus sign there. And so when m equal to -1/2, then you approach the free fermion, but you're never there. Okay, so even though I have emphasized that the our result will not depend on the specific theory and operator we use, let me nevertheless make some comment on the theory which we study. So there are now many known theories which have a dual, say, described by four gravitating ADS4. People believe there may be even many more believe to exist, but not known explicitly. So the known examples include the so-called M2 brain theory, which Subir also discussed yesterday, and the ABGM, etc. So all these known theories they contain both elementary bosons and fermions. And those elementary boson fermions, they also couple to long Abelian gauge fields, there's a large number of them, so their species typically labeled by number n, and classical gravity equals 1 to n go to infinity limit. One peculiar feature of the system is that if you look at the black hole at zero temperature, the black hole actually have a long zero horizon area. So that tells you that this theory actually have a long vanishing ground state entropy in the Lagrangian limit. In the presence of the chemical potential, yeah. So the last thing to emphasize that this is a very large and complicated system, and we are really just probing a tiny part of it.
Like
Yeah, as far as I know, the Reston Nordstrom is thermodynamically stable, and the only instability we have at the moment is this kind of superconducting stability, which these other people studied. Right, that would be like a superconducting stability. That's the same as superconducting stability. I can comment on that a little bit later. Fine. Once you look at the phase diagram of the high density superconductor, and then you don't worry about the critical point which hidden below the superconducting region. And that happens all the time in the experiments. This level, I won't worry about that. Yeah, you will show this phase diagram a little bit later. I will emphasize that point. Okay, let me say a few words on how you actually calculate this spin the retarded Green function from gravity. And so first you solve the Dirac equation for the spinner in the black hole geometry. And then you find the solution which at the horizon is an infalling wave just going into the horizon. And then you expand this solution at the boundary. And typically they have expansion like this. They have two asymptotic form at the boundary because you have two linear independent solution. And then you just take the ratio of these two coefficients. And in our case, actually this spinner, a Green function is a matrix. So they're actually two independent eigenvalues. So in my following discussion, I will just concentrate on one of them because the other is very similar. So now you can just solve the equation and just try to find the Green function. Now becomes straightforward. And so the first thing you can calculate is the following. So we are interested in finding Fermi surface. So we are interested in the behavior at a very small frequency, away from the chemical potential. So the thing you do is you look at some omega very small, say for some charge and the dimension, and then you plot this Green function as a function of k. Right, that's right. Yeah, I have set all the units to be one. Just everything will be numbered here. Hmm? That's a KFI don't know apparently. Yeah. What is the density of the? You mean the charge density of the whole system, or the for the density of the quasi particle probe? Oh right. Oh, that density is known. Yeah, that density is known. No. So that's the key thing. That's the key thing which I emphasized. So this the question is, we have a chemical potential, so you should be able to from the chemical potential get the charge density, and then you should be able to try to from the charge density deduce the Fermi momentum. So the key thing is that here, the theory contains lots of other things, and they are bosons, charged bosons, charged fermions, etc. And so we are really probing a tiny part of it. And so there's no direct relation between that charge density and the relevant one for us. Right, that's right. Exactly. So what you do is you just plot this Green function as a function of k for small omega. If there's a quasi particle peak, then you should be able to see it as a function of k. And then that's what you see here, the one component of this Green function, and now develop a peak around the say this k equal to 0.9. As I said, there are two eigenvalues, and so this is the imaginary part of the two eigenvalues. No, it doesn't have to be. Just means there's a candidate for some kind of quasi particle-like excitations. Yeah, means you have found a candidate for some kind of quasi particle-like excitations at some finite momentum, right? Some finite momentum shell. Yeah, just for convenience.
So
That's right, that's right, exactly. It's just a massless particle, which is slightly easier to calculate from the calculation point of view. Yeah, we'll describe the other dimensions a little bit later. No. This is not. This is the dimension of the operator in your parent in your UV theory. So we start with a scale invariant theory in the UV, and then we put it at the parallel density, etc. So this is a dimension for the UV theory. And now, so this plot tells you there's a candidate for some kind of Fermi momentum near 0.9. And now you can just zoom in around there, say, take k equal to 0.9, and try to plot this function as a function of omega. And then indeed, you see a very nice quasi-particle behavior. So this is the imaginary part of the Green function, this is the real part of the Green function for one of the components. For this one is k, for this one is omega. So this is at a fixed k, and you change omega. And this is at the fixed omega, you change k. And so if you do it sufficiently carefully, as David Wei did, which he calculated this number to, say, to 10 digits, and using various very impressive numerical techniques, and that's right. Yeah. Actually, in this unit I'm using, the chemical potential is equal to square root 3. Yeah, it's in the unit of the... Hmm? Yeah, this is also charge, how you define the units there, that's right. Hmm? The charge of Fermi, I also have chosen a specific unit, so that in the end, the only thing which is invariant is the charge times the chemical potential. That unit is invariant. Okay, so now we can now identify such a quasi-particle excitations. Now you can study its dispersion relation, and then you find, for example, that the they have this kind of dispersion relation with omega goes to curve like some power z, and z is 2.01 if you take the q equal to 1, charge equal to 1, and the z equal to 5.32 if you take charge equal to 0.6. Yeah, q is the charge of the particle. It's the charge of the operator. And we also find a scaling behavior near the Fermi surface. So if you try to scale your momentum and the frequency, and then you find that the Green function have a beautiful scaling behavior with exponent alpha equal to 1, and again with this the same z appear here, which is determined simply by that. The residue at this moment we cannot calculate, but this is a very good question. I will tell you that a little bit later. Okay.
So by alpha being 1, you don't mean that this is not a pole.
No. This alpha. That's right. This is a relation between how your Green function scale when you scale k. Yes. Yes. No, I'm not saying there's a small lifetime here. I'm just saying here we are finding a quasi-particle-like excitation. It doesn't have to be a stable quasi-particle. I'm not claiming there's a stable quasi-particle. I'm just saying we have found a peak, some kind of candidates. And you will see a little bit later and what we are seeing here. That's just because the Fermi have very small dimension. So the black hole geometry is controlled. Say black hole as a state, say have energy n square, and the Fermi also have energy 1. Yeah, it's not n. So you also find. Good questions, you will see, you will see. Here, just trying to get your appetite. So for the non-forming liquid, actually Z equal to alpha equal to 1. And so here, clearly, we have some candidate for the non-forming liquid. Okay, good. And so at this stage, so let me now quote my friend and colleague, Sento. He said that at this stage, ADCFT is like a black box which just spits out numbers or consists in the spectral functions. And we haven't learned any insight from here. Okay. And indeed, we'd like to know what controls this exponent. And to do that, we actually have to dissect this black box to see what's going on there. And after all, we have a black hole. So now we want to search for organizing principle for this exponent. And then you will see where does those exponents come from and what controls them. Yes. Okay. Okay. Oh, that one would be a marginal one. The stability of the UV series is a separate question which we can talk about. You are talking about the stability of the UV series, and which we can talk a little bit about later. Yeah. The honest answer is I don't know. Yeah, anyway, let's just see. So in order to gain some insight, we need to go back to black hole geometry. So let's start from this metric again. So this metric, we can again look at this radial axis. And we can divide it into three regions. So one region is r much greater than 1. And another region is r is off order 1. And the third region is very close to the horizon. So horizon is at r equal to 1. So r minus 1 much, much smaller than 1. So in this region, so at r much, much greater than 1, the f is essentially equal to 1. So essentially, you go back to the ADS4 geometry. And then this ADS4 geometry have the standard the ADS4 isometry, which is equivalent to the three-dimensional conformal symmetry, etc. And in this region, because of the effect of the black hole, the generically conformal and the Lorentz symmetry is broken. But now, if you look at the third region, now we see a surprise. We see that this region, actually, there's an ADS2 times R2. So it's a tensor, so it's a direct product. So this ADS2, so ADS we're not familiar, which have less scaling symmetry. So start from the UV, you have your conformal symmetry of your UV theory, of your parent theory. Once you go to the lower energy, by going to the interior of the black hole, then such symmetry is broken. But now we see if you are really going to the really infrared, now there's an emergent scaling symmetry due to the presence of this ADS2. And so to say it another way, if you have your frequency much, much greater than your chemical potential, of course the finite density does not matter very much. It's just like you are in the zero density. And if your frequency is order of chemical potential, and then of course everything is broken. And now if you are very, very close to the chemical potential, as in this case, and now the gravity tells you, in this case, there's an emergent scaling symmetry in your field theory. Okay, now let's, so we can actually make this a little bit more precise. We can actually define a scaling limit to decouple this ADS2 region from the rest of the geometry. So we take r equal to 1 equal to lambda times some variable, and t equal to lambda minus 1 some variable tau. I keep this data and the tau to be finite. So if you take lambda goes to 0, that equals 1 into r very close to 1, and this t to be very large. Turns out in this scaling limit, if you plug in this into your black hole metric, and then you find this. So this is your ADS2. And with this lambda dropped out. And this is your ADS2. And this is R2. And this R2 is the effective radius, curvature radius of this ADS2 region, is given by the 1 over square root 6, just for the ADS4. Sorry?
The scaling is equal to alpha as 1 because the radial scaling is the
same. I don't know. Actually, I need to think of this a little bit. I'm not sure. I think it's likely not related, but I haven't thought about it. Right. Now forget about the Fermi surface. Now we just talk about the infrared behavior of this whole theory. And then after a little bit, we will go to the Fermi surface. And then you will see the answer to your question. What does the Fermi surface reflected in the geometry? Sorry? That's a very interesting picture, but I don't know whether that's true or not. It's not quite. You will see. We will see. Then you will see whether this picture applies or not. Yeah, because I'm using plane. That's right. Yeah, the reason I got R2 is that because I used the black brain rather than the black hole. Yeah. Sorry? Sorry? Oh, fine. What I'm saying, right now I'm not worried about the instability. I will comment on the instability a little bit later. Yeah. Let's bear that in mind. Yeah. Okay. So now I can use my standard law of ADS-FT. Now I have ADS-2. Then I would say the gravity in this ADS-2 region should be dual to a 0 plus 1 dimensional safety. And now we have seen something very surprising. We have seen that at low frequency, the parent theory should be controlled by emergent infrared CFT. And this is a very highly non-trivial statement from the field theory side. And this is a many-body statement. And here, we see the power of the ADS CFT and the power from the geometry. Essentially, you can just read this non-trivial statement from the geometry. Unfortunately, not known as much about this theory. And the first thing is that it should have a zero temperature entropy. As I said before, the ground state have a non-zero entropy. And another thing is that there was a recent calculation in this ADS2 region and suggests that the asymptotic group algebra of this ADS2 region actually contains a single copy of Virasoro algebra with a non-trivial central charge. So this actually may suggest this is some kind of chiral sector of a 1 plus 1 dimensional CFT. Yes, I have R2. Yeah, R2 is like some kind of spectator, just like S5 in the ADS5 times S5. You will see the effect of R2 a little bit later. You will see the effect of R2. It's non-trivial. You will see the effect of R2. But it's like a spectator, like in the case of ADS5 times S5, like the S5 there. It's a technical, in this R2 limit, and this central charge actually is infinite. You will see that a slightly better way is to think about the momentum space, at least from the correlation function point of view. Yes? Zero temperature. Yeah. Important. Yes.
Example, there are many examples of ladder models.
Right. I think such kind of feature is something one should keep it in mind. But I think the philosophy of ADS-AFT is that we are not necessarily study a system which have all the good properties. We just want to extract some relevant dynamical information from such kind of systems. Yeah, this is a Najian limit. Yeah, this is in the Najian limit. And all, yeah. So if you at the finite n, strictly finite n, I don't know the answer whether it still have a zero temperature entropy or not. Yeah, and this is a feature we can only say at Najian.
And is the zero temperature entropy some sort of universal number, or does it depend on any kind of?
It's given by the area of the horizon, and it can be written in a very nice way in terms of the charge density of the system, in terms of a universal number, just 2 pi. It's 2 pi times the charge density of the system. Right, yeah. Right. Fine. Yeah, but I think the philosophy here is that we are looking for dynamical insights. We are not looking for a system which describes the real world. We are looking for dynamical insights. I can enumerate a hundred different defects of this theory. But I'm not going to worry about it because I'm looking for conceptual insights, right? Yeah, just like you can in ADS-AFT, you can get a confined theory, and you can have a theory which is confined, and that dynamical insight is the same as in QCD, even though those theories are very different from QCD. So I'm not going to worry about the other kind of there are many things you could worry about, but I think we're looking for some kind of conceptual insight here. So just you keep them in mind. And as far as that does not directly kill you, that's okay. Sorry? No. No, I don't think so. You mean in the non-Fermi liquid case? No, I don't think so, right? No, in the non-Fermi liquid case, this is a unique ground state. Right. Yeah. Anyway, here, I think the. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But so okay. So let's look, come back to this infrared CFT. So even though, as I said, not much is known about it. But again, the power of ADS-AFT is that using gravity, you can calculate anything you want about this theory, including operator dimension, correlation functions, essentially anything you want, even though you don't know nothing about this theory from the Lagrangian point of view, but using gravity, you can calculate anything in this theory. Okay. Right. Yes, that's right. Yeah. I mean, either some kind of conformal quantum mechanics or some kind of chiral sector of a CFT. Yeah, chiral sector of 1 plus 1 dimensional CFT. Yeah, that's right. So now let's see. So each operator in your parent theory, so let's take an operator. So now I need the blackboard. So, actually, I only need 1 minute. Okay, thanks. So, let's take a parent theory. So take operator in your UV theory, and then I just do a Fourier transform. In the spatial direction, then I get a bunch, a family of operators, actually infinite number of operators. And this would be my candidate, which I think this would be the, say, the eigenstate of the dilatation operator in the infrared CFT. So that would be the object that we'll talk about in the infrared CFT. Okay, thanks. So for each operator in the parent theory, I have a family of operator, say in terms of Fourier exponent, in the infrared CFT, which depends on time, and the k is just momentum in the transverse direction. And so using ADS2, you can calculate the conformal dimension of this operator. It's given by the dimension of your UV dimension, and also depends on the momentum, and also depends on the charge of this operator. Also depends on the charge of this operator. So, yeah. This operator at the moment is everywhere. Sorry? Yeah, this is in the boundary theory. So this is some factor of the boundary theory. And so this is the dimension of the operator. So I call delta the dimension, and then it's often convenient to write the delta as 1/2 plus this nu, that we'll use this nu a lot. So for example, you can calculate the two-point function, and also a retarded Green function in the momentum space, and then it's easier to express in terms of this nu. And it's important that this C can be calculated explicitly, the momentum dependence, but I'm not going to write it down. The only thing I'm going to tell you that this is complex, which is very important. This does not have a CFT. This does not have a singularity at KF. But you will see what thing will become. GK omega is the two-point function momentum space. Yes. Yes. No.
What is spatial dimension?
You mean the total spatial dimension? Or?
Yeah, or,
two spatial dimensions.
Can you do it in one spatial dimension?
You can do this in principle also in one spatial dimension, yeah. And the 5, 6, anything you want.
Well, in one spatial dimension, we happen to know how to solve it that way.
A resonant nostrum ADS3, in principle, the ADS3 is a little bit trickier. That we have to think a little. You might be able to do it, yeah. In one spatial dimension, you might be able to do it. Anyway, so the thing to keep in mind is that this thing is complex. And this is the two-point function of this operator in the infrared CFT. And just in frequency space. Okay, now we are equipped with the insight is that this theory we started with, when you go to low frequency, that should be controlled by some kind of infrared CFT. But how does that happen? So now let's look at it a little more explicitly. So now we would like to understand how this affects our understanding of the scaling around the Fermi surface. But in order to do that, we need to study the low frequency behavior of the correlation function, because the Fermi surface is about the low energy behavior. So for ordinary black hole with a non-degenerate horizon, this can be done directly, which has been pioneered by some stereolized coefficient, etc. And there the small frequency expansion can be done just at the equation level, you can just do it. And that's a reflection that at phi light t, and generically that the Green function is analytic at a small frequency. So you can do expansion there. But in our case, this cannot be done straightforwardly. And because we have a degenerate horizon, because we have a zero temperature extremal black hole, we have a degenerate horizon. And due to that, the omega-dependent terms in the Dirac equation always become singular at the horizon. It's always, so the small omega expansion cannot be done uniformly. Yes? Yes. Now I want to do it again. I want to do it again with this new insight.
Okay. So you already solved this problem
in the previous. The previous solved numerically. So previously the black box have given you some numbers. And now I want to redo this to get some conceptual insight. So previously we just solved it numerically. And numerically you can see immediately there's some kind of quasi-particles, like excitation exists. But you just get a bunch of numbers numerically. Now I want to see where those numbers come from. And that requires to generally understand small frequency behavior. And in particular from this infrared safety point of view. So now let's go back again to the black hole geometry. So what we do is we separate the black hole geometry into two regions. So one we call the IR region, which is ADS2 region, and then your UV region. And what you do is that you do separate small omega expansion in each region. So in the UV region, you can more or less do it straightforwardly. But in the IR region, due to the singular behavior, as I said earlier, you have to actually rescale the radial coordinate using omega. So that makes the small omega expansion in this region slightly non-trivial. And in the end, you just match them and the overlapping region. And so this is very similar to the standard IR picture, RG picture. You have some infrared physics and you have some UV physics, and then you match them at some kind of intermediate level. And indeed, I think that's exactly what's happening in the field theory. So now let me just tell you the answer. So the answer is a little bit complicated, so I give you 30 seconds to look at this answer. So first look at the upstairs. The upstairs contain two types of expansion. The first you have some analytic expansion started from B+0, and the first order, second order, etc. And then you have second type of terms, which is given by this GK omega, which is the retarded function for this OK, the Fourier transform of this operator in the IR state of T. So this GK then times analytic expansion omega. And then the similar pattern appears in the downstairs. Then the similar pattern appears in the downstairs. So, well, yeah, all this is very good question. So all these coefficients, A+, B+0, they all are K dependent, and they come from solving the Dirac equation in the UV region perturbatively. So yeah, it takes 2 minutes to derive this equation, but takes 10 minutes to explain the notations. I won't do that. So I just tell you that they're all K dependent, and then they can be found in the UV region.
So it's valid for all K?
It's valid for all K. Yeah, there's no subtlety in K. So I will call this thing my IR data, and this thing, they all, I call them UV data. And now let me look at generic momentum. The generic momentum, so again, I copy down this green function. So generic momentum, the key is that typically at generic momentum, this A+0, so this quantity, which is a function of K, is not zero. And all A and B here, they're all real. So in this case, then it's straightforward to do a small frequency expansion, just like this. So this is a leading order term, which is omega independent. But then you have this, so this F1, F2 is just some combination of this A and B. And then you have a linear term, and then you have a term proportional to this green function, the 0+1 dimensional state of T. So you see that the generic Green function have two type of contributions. From the contribution of the IR CFT and the analytic contribution from the UV physics. So this is just like very similar to the standard field theory RGO analysis. And in particular, this term dominates this term when this delta becomes smaller than 1. So when delta is smaller than 1, this is a relevant operator in the IR safety. So in the when this operator is relevant in the IR safety, so this term is dominant. But no matter what is the value of delta k, the non-analytic part is always controlled here. And also it's because all a and b are real, the only dissipative part also are controlled here. So c is the only thing complex. So all the dissipative part are controlled here. This is just omega, not absolute value. There will be. Because of the fraction power, that's right. Yeah, there will be. Yeah, but again, it's controlled by this term. It's inside this term. So non-analytic free and dissipation are controlled by this infrared safety. So now let's finally go back to Fermi surface. After this non-detour. But now there's a very natural way to understand where the Fermi surface come from the geometry point of view. Again, let me write down this master equation. So at the generic value of k, there's no singularity. So this is just as you would expect for some kind of ordinary system. You don't see funny behavior at generic k. Yes, that's right.
Yes.
No, I have not reached the Fermi surface yet. Yeah, general K means K not at the Fermi surface.
Okay. It is not a formula that is all K.
No. No, this is generic K. I mean some general value of k, and then I will specify to kf. At generic k, okay. Yeah, I think this is related. You actually have some kind of entropy. Because you have some kind of dissipation and going on. So now let's go back to the Fermi surface. Again, let me start with this master formula. And now let's suppose there exists some special value of k, which I call kf. This thing is zero. So if this thing is zero, then the small frequency expansion becomes less straightforward. Because the leading term in the downstairs becomes non-zero. Or become zero, and then this becomes the leading order term, and this or this become leading order term. So now, and by the way, I did this equal to zero can be translated into the statement is that in the outer region, the Dirac equation actually has a bound state at omega equal to zero. So this is a geometric reflection of the Fermi surface, is that the direction has some kind of bound state at omega equal to zero. So now we can expand this near kf and small omega. And then this term, if we expand it near kf, then that will give you a k-perf term. And then I will keep the linear term here. And then I will keep this term, non-analytic term here. And upstairs, I only need to keep the first term. And then I rescale everything just so that here is 1 for convenience. And then for this case, then I have such a form. And again, this GK is given by this formula. And all these quantity KF, H1, H2, VF, they are real, and they are given by the UV data. Z, K and omega, you say here? Oh, that depends on, it depends on the relation between these two. Depend on, that's a key point, yeah. It depends on the relation between the two. And now, if you plug in this, plot this in your computer, say, and then this precisely giving rise to the quasi-particle peak, which we studied numerically before.
Okay. What frequency is and what is the
Okay, we're very happy because this is very important. So G on the left hand side is a 2-point retarded function in your full theory, in your UV theory, of some fermionic operator. Yes, yes.
What you're calling UV, supposed to be what we are measuring?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And so that would be the operator. For example, this would be the 2-point function of the electron operator. Okay. So she was asking whether this would be the quantity which the experimentalist measure in the lab.
Hmm? Well, there are multiple CSTs around right now. There's UV, CST,
IR, CST,
right?
I'm sorry. So let me say the logic again. So I start with a parent theory, which we are interested in know whether that theory have a Fermi surface or not. And then we look at some fermionic operator in that theory. And this would be the 2-point function. Which is the 2 plus 1 dimensional theory. And that's the Green function in that theory.
For some operator. Dual.
Right, that's have a gravity dual. And now, and I argued earlier that this big theory, if you go to the infrared, is controlled by 0 plus 1 dimensional CFT.
So, where we do the measurement is not IR.
Hmm?
So where we do the measurement.
Right.
To UV.
Yeah, you measure this quantity.
Right.
You measure this quantity. But all the physics is controlled here. It's controlled by this IR quantity. Sure.
Yeah, what's really confusing with me is we usually think about, say, I don't know, first quantiparticles or near Fermi surface excitations as low energy physics. So
right.
We call that IR physics. That's
yes.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Right, yeah, so let me say the logic again. You said we are calculating this quantity, which is the 2-point function of your parent, of your theory started with. And then what we argued is that this theory, when you go to the low energy, is controlled by a lot of CFT, and this is a correlation function of the other infrared CFT, and that's determines non-analytic behavior of this full Green function. That's right. Sure, yeah. But the key thing is that this one is controlled by some infrared theory. And now let's look at this expression a little bit. So now let's look at the expression a little bit, because this controls all the important physics we need to know. Sorry? It's round. It's always round, because we have spherical symmetry here. It's circle. It's a round, yeah. It is a circle. Yeah, it is a circle. That's right. Yeah, it's just when we look at this 2-point function, the curvature does not come into the story. No, it. So I'm looking at. There's only radial dependence. all these things depend on K, and we just expand to the leading order at KF.
No.
No, the K is general K. Yeah, K perv is measured from the from the. See, this one is just a general K, and I can expand this at KF. Then I take the leading order term. Then that just gets determined by the value at KF. That will have some analytic dependence on the K perv, and which will be subleading compared to this term. Then I dropped it. I dropped it. So I keep. In some sense, you can say that it just really very close to the Fermi surface. H2 is a function of K, but in order to write it to the lowest order in K perf and in omega expansion, I have expanded around the KF, and then I have thrown away the higher order terms. So in principle, they all depend on K. Yes. It's always in the radial direction. No. No, you cannot see that in the two-point function. Between the two-point function, everything is spherical symmetric. Sorry? For this one? No. No, this can only be found numerically. Yeah. This ultraviolet data, you have to solve this Dirac equation, then you can find it numerically.
Yeah.
Sorry? What's fixed the scale of KF? It's the chemical potential. So everything is fixed by the.
So this is direct correspondence between its density, the overall density expected from the chemical potential. And the volume enclosed by the furniture?
Yes.
Just like the living volume?
Here, I'm not sure whether the Luttinger theorem applies. And if you have a quasi particle, in the case which you have a stable quasi particle, I would assume it's the same. That's right. Yeah. Okay, good. Right. Yes, exactly. That's right. Sorry? You mean here? Here is exact. Yeah, here is exact. Oh, here also depends on K. This also depends on K. I also expanded at the KF. Is that what you're asking? Yes, okay. Okay. No. Oh. That omega minus K, that omega plus K is my omega. So my omega is already the chiral variable. And this K is some kind of internal index to this CFT.
I think his tears. No, it's not like that at all.
Okay, right.
His IR CFT is at every point in K, not just on the Fermi surface. And that's why, so the delta sub K doesn't know anything about the Fermi surface.
Yeah, this formula does not. No. This omega have nothing to do
omega
with perpendicular k.
It's mu.
No. You should imagine. Sorry. Yeah, just.
We know the answer.
You should imagine. Yeah. When I say this is like a chiral safety, this the variable in this chiral safety is just this omega. The omega is the chiral variable in this chiral safety. There's no other k in this chiral safety.
It's so when he says omega, his omega is omega minus mu. And you were saying 1 plus 1 equals omega minus k. Yeah. Here it doesn't go at all. It's very, very different.
No, but if you do this, you work with omega.
I know. That's different. This result is completely different. And it's also not like having one CFT on every point of the Fermi surface. It's not like that at all. It's at one it's a CFT everywhere in k. It's different. Right?
No. Okay, let's continue. Okay, so again, the important thing in this formula is this exponent. So now let's look at the different situations for this exponent. So first, let's look at the case which is this operator in the infrared is relevant. So if this operator is a relevant operator, then say if this nu delta is smaller than 1, and then this will have a smaller power than this one, that small frequency, this term will dominate. So I can drop this linear term. So that's what I get. I get it with an exponent. So this delta is smaller than 1, and the delta is 1/2 past nu, and this 2 nu is smaller than 1. So now you can study the pole structure of this function. And then you find that this has a dispersion relation like this with k to the power k perp to power z. And now z is given by this 1 over 2 nu. So this is the omega star, I mean the real part of the pole. And the gamma is the imaginary part of the pole. So in this case, the real part, the imaginary part of the pole divided by the real part of the pole is always it's a constant, does not depend on k. So it just follows from this formula, from trying to solve this formula. And so if you plot it in a complex plane, then when you change k, the motion of the pole is just like a straight line. So now you can also study the residue. Then you find that the residue is proportional to k perv to this power. So when nu is smaller than 1/2, so when delta is smaller than 1, and this thing is greater than 1, or this thing greater than 0, and then you find the residue goes to 0 as k perv goes to 0. So that tells you the residue goes to 0 at the Fermi surface. So here we find a situation which we have quasi particle-like peak. But this quasi particle, once you if you scale toward the Fermi surface, it's never stable because the imaginary part and the real part is some constant, does not depend on k. And also there's a zero residue at the Fermi surface.
So when I try to see how it looks like the surface goes up,
yes. So the imaginary part of G would be like this. Let me just say something like this. Yeah, just something like that. So in this case, clearly there's no quasi particle description. So in order to distinguish it from the other situation, I call this to be a singular Fermi liquid. Yeah, I don't have the density of. Spectral function is zero at the spectral is Yeah, that's the same as Fermi liquid. It's zero. It's the same as a lambda Fermi liquid. Yeah, you have a quasi particle peak, but here it's always zero, and omega equal to zero is always zero. So now if we look at if this operator is relevant, if it's relevant and this mu is greater than 1/2, then this number is greater than 1, then this linear term will dominate. And this linear term will dominate. But still, because C is the only complex thing, so we will keep that term. So in the limit, which when you go to the Fermi surface, then you have a linear dispersion relation, say for the real part of the pole. And then the imaginary part of the pole, which is now controlled by these, now compared to the real part, goes to zero. And now you have a finite residue. So now this is a situation, we have a linear dispersion relation, and the quasi particle becomes stable as you scale toward the Fermi surface, and there's a non-vanishing residue at the Fermi surface. So this is like a generating quasi particle. The quasi particle picture applies, so I will call it, even though the generic this exponent is not true, so nevertheless I will call it Fermi liquid. So in contrast to the lambda Fermi liquid, which this exponent is strictly true. So for this Fermi liquid, with this general exponent, so for example, we would expect, for example, the Nottinger theorem should apply, but it should have different thermodynamic and transport properties compared to lambda Fermi liquid. So it would be interesting to understand what's happening in this case.
Why do you think there's any difference in the Nottinger liquid between the two cases? I mean,
Between this case and the earlier case?
Yeah.
The early one, you don't have the, you don't even have a quasi particle at the Fermi surface.
In many examples, no, but that Luttinger theorem has very little to do with that. In all the examples we know, the Luttinger theorem applies in both cases.
Yes. But at least in all the proof I know in the Luttinger, in all the proofs I know about the Luttinger theorem, I don't know how to apply it to the earlier case. And you may say the empirical level it seems to apply, but all the proof I have seen it does not seem to apply to the earlier case.
I think if you take the
For example, if you take this most recent Oshikawa's paper, that doesn't. So in our case, we cannot do Luttinger theorem because we don't know the density.
Right.
Sorry? For this one you will get a divergence. It's because of the UV structure. So this have a different UV structure than the standard. For example, the anyway, so now let's look at if this operator is marginal. If this operator is marginal, say if delta equal to 1, then this will have power 1, which will be comparable to this term. But also it happens that both these coefficients actually has a pole at, say, this nu equal to 1/2. Then what happens is that the pole of these two cancel, and then you actually get a logarithm term. Because then you get a structure like this, which is this C1 tilde is real and this is complex. So in this case, the singularity of the retarded Ingram function is a branch point rather than a pole, and then the residue goes to zero as a logarithm. There's a whole contour of the mass and charge. You will see. So this is actually precisely the marginal Fermi liquid, which people used in 1989 to describe the high TC cuprate near the optimal doping. Okay. So now we see that this term marginal is indeed very appropriate because it arises from a marginal operator. So you can also ask, when does the number of Fermi liquid arise? So in this case, we can take this take this exponent to be 2. But in our case, when you take that to be 2, again, the coefficient becomes divergent, and the cancelling between the different terms, you will get the logarithm term. So in our case, instead of getting the standard omega squared term, you actually get the omega squared log omega term, which actually dominates over that term. In the two dimension. No, this is generic dimension. In the two dimension for what case?
2D Fermi.
So you say really?
No.
Just for Fermi interaction. In the 2D, but not in 3D. Yeah. So this formula actually applies to any dimension. So this formula applies to any dimension, including d equal to 3. And yeah. So this is not the formula. Sorry. Oh yeah. Say they say for d equal to 2, then this may apply maybe the same as a Fermi liquid if they say about the logarithm is true. Okay. This is fine. I think this logarithm is fine. This logarithm does not make it non-normalizable. Yeah. And this applies to any safety with a gravity dual. Sorry?
You
need we need some Nagyian limits, that's right. For all the examples below, you have a gauge field. For all the examples below. No, here I don't need to assume it. Just in the examples, in the examples of the boundary theory below, they all contain some gauge field. No, I don't need to assume that, no. You need a Nagyian limit. You need just in all the examples we know, you need a Nagyian limit, you need the gauge field. Yeah, but whether that's required to have a gravity dual, I don't know. Just in all the examples we know, that's the fact. Right. Okay, so let me speed up a little bit. So, but this is the modular to this d equal 2 comment, which I would like to learn a little more, that this leads to a particle hole symmetry. So let me just summarize my IR data. Maybe I'll never get to UV. So operator dimensions, so what I have shown is that the operator dimensions in the IR DFT controls the scaling exponent near the Fermi surface. In particular, if this is irrelevant, then you get a singular Fermi liquid, there's no quasi particle description. And if it's irrelevant, then you have a Fermi liquid with a well-defined quasi particle description. And if it's marginal, then you get a marginal Fermi liquid. And it seems like in our case, and the lambda Fermi liquid never exactly arise. So do people or want to escape, or still have a few minutes you want to? Sorry? That I don't know. I think they're weakly interacting due to the for example, if you want to calculate the scattering amplitude between them, and that's from, let's try to calculate scattering amplitude between them. So that's a four-point function in ADS, so that will be surprised by 1 over n squared. right. So that would be the surprise by the sign one. Yeah, 10 meters. Okay, I will see. Okay. Okay, so now I will try to give you a phenomenological description of the results we find. So again, let's start with this separation of the UV region and the IR region. So we solve the equation in the UV region and the IR region, and we match them. So also, our retarded Green function can be formally written as something like this. It says I have a function, analytic function of omega, and then I have a lot of analytic function of omega times this. This script G, which is controlled, which is non-analytic and controlled by this infrared SFT, and so both of them are real and is controlled by the UV and analytic in omega. So this both picture, this matching picture, and this result suggests a following effective action for our system. He said we can write down, say, effective action for the UV physics. Say just say we separate this operate O into a UV part and an IR part, and then we have write down some kind of effective action just capture the UV part which is analytic in omega, and then the fact that there is a matching between the IR region and UV region can be written as some kind of mixing between this IR operator and the UV operator. Then be some kind of coupling constant. And now, then you assume that this IR operator is controlled by some IR CFT. So essentially, you imagine, say, so for example, you imagine in the situation, say you have a free fermion, you have a free fermion Fermi surface. But now you couple this fermion to some kind of non-trivial CFT. And now you integrate out this. Instead of integrate all UV, you integrate all this CFT operator.
Your IR fermion sits at all K, not just on the surface.
Sure. But the Fermi surface is controlled by those things evaluated at the Fermi surface. Right. So yeah, then your full Green function can be just considered as the insertion, say, of your IR, of your IR operator. Using this Green function, so and then you can get this form. So this is very similar. So this generic form is very similar. This is very similar to actually the way how this Varma et al. Derived. They argue for their marginal Fermi liquid for this high TC cuprate, and this also have the same structure, say this non-Fermi liquid in the case which you couple to your gauge field. Say, as studied by many people, including Joe. And so maybe generic non-Fermi liquid can be understandable using this language. So now let me say another dynamical phenomena can happen in this story. Right, this is, no. No, this is not, so what I get is not, I'm not writing down a local theory. This is just a phenomenological way, say I can calculate the retarding function for the full theory. It's that you imagine there's a UV part, and then there's a part which is coupled to the IR, and then IR part just comes from in terms of some kind of mixing term, and then you just get this form. Yeah, of course, if you integrate the module, you will get very long locals here. And this is a long local. For example, this can be, say, if you take this as a free field, and you can, in principle, use this way to generate non-Fermi liquid. Sorry? Which is not a free, you say this one? This nine. This one. No, this one I have not specified what is this. No, I have not specified what is this.
the three-point functions of OI. That's what he means, three and four-point correlators of OI.
Sorry. Right. Yeah, but I think
there's nothing.
Yeah, to your function. If you're only interested in the two-point function.
There's nothing.
Yeah, let's perform it.
Right. Okay. Okay. So let's discuss a lot of possible dynamical phenomena here. So again, let's go back to this master formula, which in that form, and then it's actually possible in certain dimension range. Say for delta, satisfy this equation. So this is charge, and d now is the general space-time dimension. So previously I considered d equal to 3, but this formula is so simple, so I can just put general d here. So when delta satisfies this formula, it's actually for this, it's possible for this exponent to become pure imaginary. So the remarkable thing is that in this case, the full theory, actually there's no instability, even though your infrared theory have an imaginary exponent. And now your small frequency expansion have this form, and now you have an imaginary exponent in your frequency. So that will lead to, say, a discrete scaling symmetry, say, which is also reflected if you plot the imaginary part and the real part of the Green function, it will be periodic in the log omega. In the periodic in log omega. So far, I just say, suppose there's some KF, this is equal to zero, then we have a Fermi surface. Then I described. Right. Yes. Sure, exactly. Oh, interesting. Yeah, this is a very interesting question, which I will comment on in a little bit. Okay. So the short sentence is that for scalar, that will be at least instabilities. For scalar, the same analysis will apply, but you will see instability. So what I describe is just what can in principle happen near the Fermi surface, given the analytic structure of the correlation function. So if you really know what's really happened, so you have to study the UV data, for example, for what values of Q and delta are Fermi surfaces allowed? And how does the Fermi momentum depend on Q and delta, etc.? So, right, I think I need to maybe
meeting at 3:30.
Right, I think I need maybe another 5 to 8 minutes. five, okay.
Yeah.
So one can show that the only for delta satisfy this relation, that the Fermi surfaces are allowed. And in particular, say, in particular, you can study like what is the range of KF as a function. Yeah, just as a function of the conformal dimension and the charge, etc. And for example, for dimension is 3/2, that's the range of KF can be allowed. And let me just quickly tell you that this region which the Fermi surface allows always lies inside the region which allows a log periodic behavior. So this is the formula for the log periodic behavior. It's actually, so that region is always not inside this region. And except for very tiny region of the dimension, which you can do analytic conversation, etc. So one comment is that this upper limit, precisely corresponding to corresponding to the Fermi surface, Fermi momentum corresponding to a free relativistic Fermi. Okay, so let me maybe skip this thing. So tell you, say now, responding to an earlier question which one of you asked, you said now you can map how does the dimension, how does this dimension depend on the dimension of the UV operator and the charge of the operator. So you can map such a diagram. And there are lots of things one can say about those diagrams, but given the time constraints, I will just show you that in principle one can draw them. And also you can study how the Fermi velocity depends on the dimension, etc. So now let me summarize. So the operator dimension, and again, yeah, this is what I said before. And then we have mapped out the landscape of long Fermi liquids in the landscape of theory. And now here's a funny question, which I think some of you already asked earlier. He said here we want some kind of find the 0 plus 1 dimensional infrared CFT, which seems to apply to all momentum. But well, naively, when I think about what controls the Fermi surface, one should expect some kind of one plus one dimensional CFT on each point of the Fermi surface. So I don't have a good explanation for why this is the case, and whether we can also have a picture like this for our case. So we might still be able to have a picture like this for our case, but we haven't found it yet. Okay, there are many other interesting I have not come to cover. Okay, let me just list them. So let me just list them. There are many other interesting things. And the paper will appear. So you're free to look at them. And So now there's some future questions. For example, say what are the thermodynamic properties of those coarser particles near the Fermi surface, etc. Okay, say scattering of the coarser particles and the transports, etc. So all these things can in principle be calculated. And of course they're much more complicated than what we have done so far. And so with all this data and the plus insight from the Bach geometry, So I hope we can really find the organizing principle for the long Fermi liquid. Thanks.